you know, anybody with any sense of consciousness from my generation, our generation here, certainly knows who Tom is, from the media, from his writings, from his public actions. You know, he's has the burden of being an iconic figure of our generation, but by the same token is not, you know, an icon, but continues to be very, very active and providing important leadership in struggles for justice and peace, environmental sustainability. To view a little bit, I was thinking about it earlier, you know, I have less hair than Tom, but he's older than I am. And when we were young, you know, those differences of age were significant. So when I was just in high school, Tom was the principal author of the Port Huron Statement. And I thought it might be interesting just to remind ourselves that it begins with this language. We are a people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in universities, looking uncomfortably at the world we inherit. I found myself thinking both of people in Cairo and of my children's generation. The Port Huron Statement concluded with a commitment to help bring into being a new left here in the United States, engaging allies in labor, civil rights, and other liberal forces beyond academia, and students whose rising activities and protests had been triggered by the sit-ins of the civil rights movement, and the rest, as they say, is history. But in reading that, I also found myself thinking just how absolutely current that is in terms of the mandate that's out there in front of us. In the 60s, many of us spoke and thought about how we could lead authentic and relevant lives. Among the remarkable things about Tom is that in one lifetime, he has shown us a number of ways to do that. Tom never joined Abby Hoffman in saying, don't trust anybody over 30. And now that Tom has finally gotten past 30, his education and organizing for economic justice, environmental sustainability, to end the Central Asian War, helping us to understand and address the Long War, leading the Peace and Justice Resource Center, and helping us to understand and persist in our struggles within a framework and with the courage of Sisyphus. He remains dynamic in showing us how to live engaged with the present and building for the future. Just to touch briefly on Tom's CV, he was co-founder and president of SDS, Students for Democratic Society. As a community organizer with the Newark Community Union Project, which was part of ERAP, he deeply influenced by SNCC, he helped us to develop the concept of community organizer that many of us have lived with and attempted to emulate through part of our lives. He served as a leading teacher, organizer, and courageous leader of the Vietnam-era peace movement, traveling to Hanoi and Cambodia, bringing back news, analysis, and POWs. He's perhaps best known as one of the Chicago Eight, and maybe less appropriately known for his second marriage. He is the co-founder of the Indochina Peace Campaign, and a leading figure in the campaign that succeeded in halting funding for the Indochina War, and thus its end. He co-founded the Campaign for Economic Democracy in the early 1980s, which included work for environmental protection, solar energy, and tenants' rights. He served as a member of the California State Assembly from 1982 to 1992, and the California State Senate from 1992 to 2000. I think we're fortunate that he was no longer in the California legislature come 9/11 in 2001, and can devote more of his energies to our movement. He currently runs the Peace and Justice Resource Center, has taught in recent years at Occidental, Pfizer, and Scripps College. And he's a frequent contributor to The Nation magazine. He's the author of a mere 18 books, and drawing on his Michigan origins, he's among the few Californians willing to come to New England in the middle of a hard winter. Thank you so much, Tom.
I want to thank Joseph Gerson, who's been a friend and a stalwart in the New England and even internationally in the broader peace movement. I know that he's working incessantly on these questions. I operate a newsletter which attempts to get original information about this series of wars that I call the Long War, and it goes out to people in clusters where I've spoken around the country, probably 50 or 60 cities, including NATO countries, because they're the partnership that is actually the sponsor of the occupation. I'd be delighted to just share my own analysis and information with you and hear from you. It's amazing what can be done online these days. I'm now starting to teach a class online on the war. The government of Egypt is being overthrown online. It's such a fantastic change in the world that's been going on. I have been both in the streets and in elected office, and I often get the question, especially from students, how do you compare the inside to the outside? Which is the more effective approach? And after I tell them I don't actually know, that remains to be seen. The real answer is that, like many people, I began to be organized or be activated or energized by the problems that were invading my personal life. The treatment of students in the 1960s, for example, the example of the student civil rights movement in the South. I went down to Georgia and to Mississippi. I was a freedom rider, and the issues were domestic and rooted in slavery and historic, and I wasn't looking much farther than that. But at the very time that we had this tremendous opportunity at a gradual transformation here in the United States, 1964 summer, when the Mississippi Democrats were challenging the Democratic Party, it was at the same moment that the civil rights workers were mutilated and killed in Mississippi that at the time of their funeral, the discovery of their bodies, the first American planes were off bombing North Vietnam in the name of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And that was a very heavy experience for me in the sense that for the first time I felt I had been interested in peace and disarmament and in changing our national priorities. And I'd been inspired by the Stuart Hughes campaign in 1992 here in Massachusetts that tried to make disarmament a legitimate topic of American politics. But I was really focused on my generation and the events around me. And then to discover that the obstacle was not simply Southern racism and covert national acceptance of that racism, but it was actually the war in Vietnam, which would come to escalate over all of our lives and turn our energy away from Mississippi and away from Newark, where I was a community organizer, and devour the budget for the anti-poverty programs with the budget for Vietnam, which led by 1965 to the first riots or rebellions in cities. If you'll remember, there must have been 75 of these upheavals, all, I think, related somehow. We knew they were related to Vietnam, as well as to the failure on the part of our government at every level to rapidly and effectively deal with the problem that had been around for hundreds of years, the problem of race. So I found myself feeling that I had to give up on community organizing at the time with the coming of Black Power and the coming of the Vietnam War. And I'm not going to explain the subsequent 40 years, only to say that I've been troubled by this problem of whether to work on foreign policy and wars of aggression and so forth, or domestic policy. And I've concluded that we all work where we are comfortable, where we feel that we fit. That's just in our nature. But I've seen again and again that the progression of wars has always robbed us of the ability to deal with our domestic problems fully and satisfactorily. And the wars come back in the form of the shootings of our leaders, the shootings most recently in Tucson of all those people. And so when I left the legislature, it just happened that I saw the initial phase of the bombing of Baghdad and the launching of that war, and at the same time, the launching of yet another peace movement, a massive peace movement of millions of people in only a decade ago. And so ever since, I've been trying to be a participant, but kind of a participant writer and analyst trying to understand where this war came from, and at the same time, where the peace movement came from, because unlike many other movements that have permanent organizational form and mass dynamics, peace movements seem to rise, like it or not, at times of great fear or great American casualties or the threat of casualties. If you think of the Freeze campaign that was so forcefully supported here in Cambridge and in New England, if you think of the solidarity movement with Central America, all the way from Vietnam to the present. So maybe I can offer some thoughts. I guess what I'm saying in a nutshell is that this war that we're now experiencing will come and go. It will flicker in our consciousness, just as in the past we've turned from one issue to another and back again to the original issue. We're preoccupied now primarily by presidential politics, the rise of the Tea Party, the Wall Street scandal, the unemployment crisis, the failures of our economy, the possible debacle over healthcare. And what's an activist going to do? An activist is a volunteer. What's a person going to do? We only have so much capacity to focus on anything. We go from issue to issue, and sometimes there are just too many issues for anyone to stand out the way Vietnam did for a period of time. I believe these issues have to be interrelated, yes, but generally, in my life, organizing and intellectually in writing, I try to focus on a single issue. I don't know if you're the same way, but most people I know are part of the long single issue history of protest in America. So I focused on this current war, knowing that it was going to be a theft of our future if it wasn't stopped. And it turns out there is an actual doctrine, a Pentagon doctrine, that's called the Long War. I don't think President Obama has officially endorsed the doctrine. One reason that there's not much attention paid to it, you can go to the longwarjournal.com. It's one of these little sites where everybody obsesses about their issue. And you'll find an amazing amount of material and literature about the Long War. Andrew Bacevich, who's from around these parts, is one of the few authors who's edited a big book called The Long War. It appears in the counterinsurgency writings quite frequently, as in the concept of Afghanistan or Iraq being a short war in the midst of a long one. The Long War has even crept into our legal terminology. One of the Bush appointees to the federal courts, a right-wing conservative federal judge, I think in Virginia, has ruled in an actual case involving detainees that they should never be released until the long war is over. In other words, if you pick somebody up on a battlefield in Afghanistan, the whole concept of doing their time and being released is ridiculous, she believes, because the long war is the battlefield. Afghanistan or Iraq are only partial battlefield. So the long war has crept into our society and into our culture without being discussed. The reason I think that it's not being discussed is people became pretty sour on Iraq, right? And the long war says that the duration of the long war will be between 50 years and 80 years. If you calculate, that's 20 presidential terms. That's multiple congressional two-year cycles. That's a war far into the future that will affect the lives of people not yet born. And I don't think there's much public appetite in America for somebody advocating a 50-year war, which leads us immediately into the problem of secrecy, which is one of the byproducts of this kind of commitment. It's a war that cannot be spoken of. And so, therefore, it's not really an accident that so much of our policies are now surrounded by secrecy. If you look at the cost of a 50 or 80-year conflict, we can debate it, but I think Stiglitz and Bilmes have put a $3 trillion price tag on the cost of Iraq, which will include veterans' health care. The war in Afghanistan will be a $1 trillion war by 2012 in direct costs, not counting the accrued costs of health care and the rest of it. So you're talking about two wars that are $6 trillion and not concluded and not paid for, generally speaking. You have Pakistan, which is a secret war, but is estimated to be $7 billion on the so-called civilian side, the institution-building, nation-building side. And I don't know how much has been spent on Pakistan's army. I don't know how much has been spent on the special forces in their secret projects. But if you throw in another trillion, we're at 5 to 10 trillion unpaid for. And obviously, you can't be a war hawk and a deficit hawk unless you just don't talk about it. You don't speak of it. But that's where we are, people ranting and raving about our deficits and turning over trillions of dollars for wars that are, you know, at best inconclusive. And these are not wars that generate mass employment for those out of work in America. This is not my father and mother's World War II, where the Detroit factories were turning out Jeeps and tanks and the rest of it. These are drone wars. These are high-tech wars. These are specialized wars. There might be some jobs around the high-tech industry in Massachusetts, but they're not employment generators. They're just generally a drain. The casualties are unknown. We had a big fight during Vietnam over casualties, and I think the Pentagon learned, again, that it's best not to address the issue of casualties too frontally, because for some reason, people of conscience get upset. So all the good work done on casualties has been lost and not reapplied to Afghanistan. By that, I mean there's a methodological argument over whether you can do cluster surveys. That's not cluster bombs, cluster surveys, where you go out and interview 5,000 families in geographic dispersed areas of Afghanistan or Iraq, and you can calculate what they call the excess morbidity. That is, what was the death rate before the war, and then what happened in the 5 years of Iraq or the 10 years of Afghanistan. And you can come up with figures so astounding, here's another big problem for us in terms of public opinion, that people don't believe them. If I told you 600,000 people died as a result of, civilians died as a result of the Iraq decade, or if I said 200,000, you can't get traction with the media. And people have unfortunately given up in trying to make this point, but it seems to me clear that hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in Iraq, tens of thousands have been killed in Afghanistan. American soldiers' suicide rates are at an all-time high, over 1,000 suicides in recent years. More American soldiers commit suicide than are killed on either battlefield, Iraq or Afghanistan. The death rate for American troops in the two wars is probably 7,000, but we don't really know. the casualty rate, the wounded rates, are much higher as a perverse consequence of advanced medical care. So you've got tens of thousands of suffering families as a result. I think we know all this. The point I want to make is that when the president had his review in 2009, he kept trying to get a pinpointed number of what this was costing. This is in the meetings with his staff in the White House, National Security Council, the military. It's all recounted in the very, very informative book by Bob Woodward that's called The Obama's Wars. And the president could not get a number. And then the New York Times said he went into a state of shock when he was told what the number was. I think it was something like $1 million is the per capita cost of an American soldier. But the point was not how much that soldier cost. The real sinister information that he learned was that these wars would completely devour the discretionary domestic budget of the United States, that you would have to raise taxes, which is politically unacceptable, or you would have to end the wars, or you would have to cut very deeply into domestic spending before you get to Social Security and the rest of it. So there went the domestic agenda of the Obama administration. And again, I was brought up short by this recurring pattern that I've seen in my life, where the invisible dimension of the wars, apart from what's visible, the invisible dimension destroys the underpinnings of our economy and prevents us from moving in a progressive direction at home. The starting point for a discussion has to be that we don't have the capacity to move in a progressive direction on domestic issues like environment, education, healthcare, and sustain these wars. We're living on borrowed time in a number of ways. So what can we do as a practical matter? My own view is that the movement is as diverse as our ecology, which is a way of saying you'll get flowers and weeds, things will rise and fall, it can be beautiful, it can be ugly. There's no controlling a real social movement. I don't even advise people to take my path of a single focus. If they want to focus on the whole catastrophe of the world, fine. I do that as a thinker and writer. I find it unbearable, by the way. But when I wake up in the morning and start my coffee, I already know what I have to do because I'm working like a craftsperson on one project and one project alone, which is to end all these wars. And that's enough. So we don't have models here. The Vietnam War did not exactly end because we led a campaign to cut off funding by Congress. That was a factor. But in the bitter end, our Congress, which was more liberal than this Congress, the Congress in the 70s, did not have the courage to cut off funding. They had the courage to propose a cutoff, but there was always a loophole. And Nixon, to the end, believed that if South Vietnam started to fall, as they say, he would resume bombing. He wanted to get the American troops out and start bombing. What brought him down was the watchful eye of the security guard at the Democratic National Headquarters in the Watergate building who noticed the tape on the door. It was not an investigative reporter that started this. It was once again, in the course of history, a small act by a person who was not politically engaged or part of an organization. Nixon crashed because of Watergate and did not have the capacity to order an attack or get Congress to support an attack, or he would have carried out, I believe, and Ellsberg and others believe, another bombing attack. So Congress tried, far more than this Congress, but Congress tried to end it. Congress was a factor. the anti-war movement was driving Congress. It wasn't the other way around. But even then, there's something about the nature of our state that when it's in crisis, it doesn't heed public opinion very easily. It doesn't heed the will of Congress very easily. It doesn't heed the editorials. It reacts on a reptilian basis to the threat to its existence, to the threat to its reputation, to the threat to its dominance. And Vietnam was lost to the state because of the North Vietnamese Army and Southern Liberation Front and Nixon's overreaction. I guess we could argue that our movement's very existence caused him to overreact. That might be a plausible scenario. Now, how does that apply to the current situation? I think this may sound like an unnecessary historical talk, but I'm convinced over 50 years of activism that the state has a better institutional memory than we do. And the state is always reacting on the base of what it has learned from the past, while activist generations come and go. But it's the same state. It may have an African-American president, a more diverse complexion to the Congress, the Democratic Party, but it's the same. It's a Machiavellian state that has a single purpose, which is to expand its reputation and power over resources. And if it has to move in one direction to do that or another direction to do that, it will do so. So we have to keep that in mind, and it seems to me that the strategy could be this, that you want to apply local people power to the pillars that underlie the policy of the state. There are certain things that are required by a war. First, you have to have soldiers. Second, public support. Third, money. It goes on. But let's just take those pillars. What I wake up and think about is how, first pillar, public opinion, how are we doing with public opinion? What am I doing today to convince an undecided person to decide? What am I doing to convince a disillusioned person to become a dissenting person? But I'll stop there on that practical note. And just in conclusion say, the good news is that if the American people ever heard about the Long War, they would be horrified. The bad news is they'll never hear about it unless you make it known that these people in Washington and the Pentagon plan to go from war to war to war until every Muslim they don't like is dead. As a matter of fact, this is what an Ivy League education will get you. Bruce Rydell, the chief advisor to Obama in the review at the Brookings Institution, actually said during the review, "Mr. President, we have to keep killing them until they stop killing us." That's where we are. That's the thought process currently exhibited in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much.